This is the Home Tech Podcast, show number 42 for September 1st, 2011. I am your host, Jim Collison, broadcasting live from the AverageGuy.tv studios here in sunny and beautiful today. Actually kind of hot, but it's going to get cooler this weekend on this holiday weekend here out of Bellevue, Nebraska, and posted each week at TheAverageGuy.tv. You can contact the show. You can send us an email, podcast@TheAverageGuy.tv. Follow me on Twitter. That's just @JCollison, or find us on Facebook. And we're getting a few more folks on Facebook every week. Just search The Average Guy Podcast. One of the things I am trying to do with Facebook is move many of the show comments and many of the post comments that we put on TheAverageGuy.tv. For whatever reason, Christian, this is a problem that people log in and then it doesn't look like they're logged in, and they try and leave comments and people can't get that figured out. So it's okay. I don't really want to fix it. Go over to Facebook, find TheAverageGuy.tv, post it over there. But I blame you for that, Christian.
All right, thank you.
All right, you bet. I want to remind folks as well that we are changing over all the RSS feeds, and I got called on that today too. I said that in the last podcast, or in one of the podcasts, that we were changing them all over, and somebody reminded me today that I hadn't got the Financial Tech Podcast moved over yet. That is true. I'm a little behind. But by the end of September, we'll have all the RSS feeds for both fitness, home, and financial tech podcasts moved over to TheAverageGuy.tv, or FeedBurner is really where they're going. So if you haven't changed your RSS feed yet, go out to the site, click on one of the links, either for iTunes, or you can grab the FeedBurner RSS and plug that into any podcatcher you want, and that will change it over. September 31st, it'll go away, and you'll stop getting podcasts. So get that done today. I also want to remind folks that we have this cool, awesome Drobo giveaway going on right now. We talked a little bit about it last week. I was going to post some stuff out on our site, but it's just as easy to go over to thehomeservershow.com and get that. So if you haven't been over there, which I find it hard to believe, I think most of the listeners here are probably from the Home Server Show. HomeServerShow.com. Look for the Drobo contest post on there. A quick couple things. You just need to click a link, go to Drobo, and register. Tweet about it. Make a comment there on the post, and you'll be entered to win a Drobo S. Looks something like that right there. Although that's a Drobo FS that I'll be doing some reviews on over the next couple months, maybe 6 months, Mario. And so that'll be there. Yeah. The one that you're going to win is actually over here. It's a Drobo S, USB 3, and eSATA. So if you don't know what a Drobo is, check out Drobo.com. Very cool external storage device that kind of handles all your backup needs, and you can just throw hard drives in it. You don't have to worry about RAID. It has its own RAID, and very cool. Lots of write-ups there at TheAverageGuy.tv as well on the local Drobo dashboard, as well as I've got some posts coming out on some new backup software that Drobo has created. All right, I want to introduce the hosts that are out here with me tonight. Since I started, and I never start with you, Christian, so Christian Johnson, he's the site administrator and stud behind all things bios-mods.com. And Christian, every week it seems like we do a user check-in on how many you're up to at BIOS Mods. Did you break what's the record we're trying to shoot for on users there?
Well, we just broke 20,000. We're at a fantastic 21,598 right now.
Nice. And there's a daily number that you're trying to get to, right? Like 3,000?
Yeah, we're trying to hit 3,000 unique IDs uniques a day.
And so Christian is behind that. Christian, your summer is drawing to a close. That has to be a little sad for you.
A little sad, yeah, definitely.
And you're back in school after Labor Day?
Yep.
All right. Well, we'll keep you busy till then. I appreciate you. We started a new site called radracing.org, and you helped me get that moved over. I've done nothing to it since we got it there. Sorry. But I appreciate your help on that as well. Also joining us tonight and not feeling as well as he could, but joining us anyways, Andrew Morris. Andrew, how are you?
Good. Thanks, Jim. It's good. A bit husky today, so.
Yeah.
If I have a choking fit in the background, I'll try to go on mute in the meantime.
Very good, very good. Well, I'm glad you've made the effort to join us this morning for you, or almost around noon. And we're glad you're out. We also have with us this evening Mike Howard. Mike is behind JPEG to RAW and a fellow podcaster, and has come on the show tonight to talk a little bit of photography with us. So, Mike, how are you doing this evening?
Doing great, Jim. Getting a little cooler here, too, this weekend, so I'm looking forward to that.
Hot Atlanta.
We've been hot, too, up in the mid-90s. I'm ready for some cooler weather.
I heard Texas is having a huge heat wave, and it's been, I think they're on their 86th day where the temperature in Dallas has been over 105 degrees or something stupid like that. It may be the 68th day, but anyways, that's still a really long time to be that hot. But hopefully they'll get some cooler weather soon. I know Irene caused some damage last weekend. Hopefully, if you're listening to this podcast, you are safe and sound. If you're living in Vermont, Vermont just got destroyed. Oh, good heavens. We do Spartan Radio as well, and the headquarters for Spartan is in Vermont, and the office has not done well. So it's I feel that's the very first – one of the few storms I saw that actually gained more power as it went up the East Coast, and it just – dump tons of rain. So if you're listening on the East Coast and you're flooded out, we hope you're safe and sound and getting some help now.
Yeah, we actually had to cancel my show Tuesday night because my guest was up in that area, and he had lost power about 2 hours before the show started. And I talked to him the next day, and he still hadn't got power.
Yeah, lots without – New York City really kind of escaped without much trouble. But, ironically, the same day we had a transformer blow in our neighborhood, and I just put a brand new UPS in. It's 1,000 milliamp, how do they measure that again? 1,000, help me out, guys.
KVA.
Okay.
1,000 VA.
600, yeah, VA, there you go. Thank you. And a 600 watt. And the power was out for about 5 hours. Amazingly, my PC must have went into some kind of power save mode. And when the power came back on, it just came back. Everything I'd had that morning was still there.
That's nice.
And so, yeah, I was surprised. The home server shut off, which doesn't have as much nice little gear on it. So that one went down. But the main PC, the Core i3, stayed on. So if you're not using battery backups, Christian, you got a UPS on your beast there?
Yeah.
How big is that for what you run?
I think it's all right, I'm going to just check to be sure. But,
okay.
It's an XPS 1000. Yeah.
Yeah, so same size.
Yeah.
Same size as mine. Mike, you have everything that you own on a UPS?
No, I have my server setup is on two UPSs. I got them split between two UPSs, and I'm slowly buying UPSs for the family. I don't have one actually on my PC. But I'm got one for my boys, and they got one, and now next will be me.
Yeah, I put them on all. Andrew, I assume you've got UPS on your stuff?
No. Really? Our power's pretty reliable. We've been in this house for 2 years and a couple of weeks' time, and we've had the power go out once, and that was when a possum shorted out a transformer. So,
yeah.
We really had that.
I bought one a few months back, but the home server wouldn't monitor it, so I took it back and never got around to getting another one.
Yeah, Mike, go ahead.
We rarely lose the power here either, so it's not a big concern.
We have these little brownouts, and they last for a minute or two, and they come at the weirdest times, and it just drops and comes back. And I just got tired of resetting everything, and including like the microwave. Now, I would never put a UPS on the microwave, but you get tired of resetting the time and the date and all that stuff that you got to set.
Sure.
So, they double as a surge protector. I don't know, for me, it's great. So I had a small one that I had three on. I think I talked about this a couple weeks ago. I had a small one on there. I did a post at theaverageguy.tv as well. And I gave that smaller one to one of the kids on their PC, and so that's backed up now. And we do have some power problems. And I just think most homes have some where people live where the power drops. So I just think it's a smart thing to put on.
Yeah, I'm going to slowly be replacing mine, because what we have is, if we're going to lose power, it's one of those ones where you lose it for a couple seconds, comes right back on.
Yeah,
those type of things. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the last time we've lost it for a long amount of time. So for those things, I want to get one, for every one of us. But I'm buying them, slowly, because they're a little more expensive than a regular surge.
Yeah, thing. Well, you can find them on sale at Office Depot or Office Max or whatever your local big box store is in Australia. At least here in the U.S., you can get sometimes Best Buy runs them on sale for $40. And that's double the price of a nice surge protector, but they last 3 or 4 years, and you get good. And you know, they'll even go longer if you're just using them for those little brownouts.
And that's, you know, we found them at, I think, Sam's Club. We found one for about $45, $42, mm-hmm. something like that. That is, you know, more than good enough for my kid's computer and my wife's computer.
Yeah.
I may want something a little better for mine. Mm-hmm.
Christian, you guys have a big kind of home server set up there, right? Some hardware. Does your dad have a fairly good UPS backup on that?
Yeah, we have about we have another 1,000 on the server rack. There's a couple 500s floating around the house, so everything's pretty much on a UPS.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. Do you guys have power problems at all?
Very rarely.
Okay. All right. Well, it's a good thing. It's one of those average guy things. I think it's one of those things that a lot of people don't think about. I just like to have them everywhere, and then I kind of rotate them around. So as one goes bad, I replace it with a new one and make sure you dispose those batteries properly. Well, something kind of interesting happened to me today. I didn't put this in the show notes, but I thought I'd run it by you guys real quick. And I wanted to talk a little bit in conjunction about OpenDNS and this topic of discussion. Christian, this may be something you can check on as well. So today I checked my email and I send all the site registrations that I get through WordPress to a separate folder, and that typically gets me one or two registrations to the site a day, maybe one every other day. Kind of depends on what's going on. Typically, those are spammers coming in. I don't get a lot of people to register. Maybe one in five is a real person. I have no way of telling. I don't worry about it too much. The site does a nice job of catching spam and not allowing it to get into a post. But today, Christian, I got about 15 registrations to just today. And I kind of thought, that's odd. So I started going back and checking the, you know, who registered. And they were these odd email addresses that are like, you know, I don't know, something made up at yy.com. You know, it started looking like a lot of spam. And I went into the posts. And I started looking through, and there was tons of spam now. Now, I'm not a very big site, which makes me think that this is an automated, you know, this is being set up in an automated basis. But, Christian, have you seen any increase in the site that you administrate? Do you check that spam to see if you've been getting more spam recently?
Yeah, well, I'll go ahead and dive into a bit of Christian's corner because that was part of what I was going to bring up this
week. Oh, sweet.
Week.
Yeah.
This month has been a horrible, horrible influx of spam just in general on all of my servers. And for me, not as much Word commenting, WordPress commenting, because I have a plugin that it's impossible for a spammer to post because they have to actually physically copy and paste a password string before they comment, which there's no current bot out there that does that correctly, so it's pretty much full human, foolproof there. So one big issue, though, is MyBB form software, PHB BB form software. All these form softwares have really been getting hit hard, and I was looking for a solution that would enable me to try and make sure I'm not blocking legitimate users, but I'm still getting the bad guys, because I was getting maybe 20 to 30 spam registrations a day. And
so you're seeing that too, huh?
Yeah, and it was just something about this month that was really uncontrollable, and I had my moderators working like 24/7 trying to clear out the spam. So I'm like, all right, this has to stop. So there's this great website called stopformspam.com. And what it is it's a huge spam database where everyone who owns a form, it's kind of almost like Wikipedia where everyone contributes. Whenever someone sees a spammer on their form, they report the email address, username, and IP address to stop form spam, and then it gets verified and put in the database. So I think there's some 800,000 entries. Let's see what it's at right now. .com. They have 6,820,282 records in their database of form spammers. So what I have installed is a plugin that whenever someone tries to register at my site, it checks that registration against the Stop Form Spam database. And if it's in that database and it's a bad email address, then it automatically gets bounced. And in the last 5 days, that plugin has probably blocked about 200 spammers and has saved a lot of time and trouble. And then I also wrote a PHP script that scans form databases for users that already registered before the filter was installed, and it'll scan your entire user database and see if anyone was a spam registration before.
Nice. So, nice.
Yeah, so and it's really useful because I decided to contribute back. I put BIOS mods in the contributors page on Stop Form Spam, and whenever I see something, I just forward it off to Stop Form Spam.
So what's the manual effort required on a daily basis from you, or is it completely automated?
I've automated it so that I wrote a script line into my administration panel that I just click a button, report to Stop Form Spam, and off it goes.
Of course you did.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice. Well, you know, one of my thoughts on this, guys, and I don't want to be an alarmist, and I'm not typically this way, but the 10th anniversary of 9/11, of course, is coming up here in a week. 10 days. And from the recording of this date, I think at least my thought today was maybe there's an effort going on to take over, you know, to begin to control. Of course, these spammers want to put links in that to sites that are compromised and hope that people will click on them. And if their antivirus is not up to date or they don't have any antivirus or whatever, that they can control those PCs. And that maybe there's a pretty decent cyber attack against the United States coming up that someone can claim as their own. And so as this increase of – I'm not saying that's what it is, and I know nothing about this. So Department of Defense, don't call me. I don't know anything about it. I'm guessing here, okay, only what I've seen. But the reminder is make sure your antivirus is up to date and installed and running and working, because everybody – there's big money in selling these bot farms or these bot – what do they call them? Bot networks of PCs that are basically just clones that do whatever that they tell them to do. So get your antivirus updated is what I'm saying. Is that good enough? Okay. Yep. Speaking of antivirus, and I don't know if you guys use it, but I use OpenDNS. Just as we're talking home security here for a second, and DNS just announced this week, if you are using OpenDNS, actually them and Google and VeriSign have made are doing, and I'm not going to get into the details of this. I just thought this technology was kind of cool. So they're embedding some technology in some of the traffic routing that they do that attempts to get the request to go to the closest source for it to speed up your internet service. And I'll drop a note I'll drop a link in the show notes that has the entire article in it. But you know, as we get a more and more crowded internet out there, I think that's only going to become more and more important that we route this traffic to the right place the first time without having to go all over the web. And I know the web's designed for redundancy, so it's supposed to happen that way, but it would be nice if the shortest route was available, that especially as you're streaming video and video becomes more important, that the shortest distance between two points is your point to the server point, and it doesn't go any around anywhere else. So I thought that was kind of cool. Either you guys, anybody else use OpenDNS? Mike?
I use Google, and I wanted to ask you, why do you use OpenDNS? What is OpenDNS?
Same thing as with your Google. It's just a set of DNS routers that you can point your network to that they they're faster. They actually optimize their servers for speed. And then they do some content filtering as well. So they do like sites that have been compromised, they get filtered out. So it's been a nice, from a security layer, it's been a nice thing to add to my network.
Huh, that's something to look at. I've heard that before too. I downloaded some piece of software where you put it on your computer. It tests you against a bunch of DNS servers, yep, and finds from your location which one is the fastest. And for me, that was Google. And that's what I'm using.
And that's a like 8.8.8.8 or something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
Alternative 8.8.4.4.
Yeah.
Okay. Did I have that right, Christian?
You did.
Wow.
Very impressive.
Mm-hmm. Holy crap. How did that happen?
So for me anyway, OpenDNS was high, but I think it was like third or fourth. And my ISP provider, you know, internet service provider, was not in the top five.
No, they never are. Right? I mean, I use Cox Communication here in Omaha, and they are just stupidly slow.
Yeah, but I think most people use their internet service provider instead of
– Well, they don't, yeah, like
they don't know any different.
Yeah. Your average user doesn't even know what a DNS is. So.
Right.
And I mean, I've connected to – there's like several nodes for OpenDNS, and I think our – our server 08 manages all the DNS for our network, but it also checks against OpenDNS. And I actually just randomly tried out some Google DNS today because of a SMTP issue, which I'll get into much later in Christian's Corner. So both of them were relatively fast. I was getting pretty high TTLs from both of them. So,
yeah, you know, I've liked OpenDNS. It works well. I think I used 208.67.222.222. I think that's the one I pulled off their site. And that's supposed to be just down the street here in Indianapolis or something like that. And I've had really good luck with it. I haven't had many things stop that I didn't think should be. And they have a little blog as well, really helpful blog. It's just that extra security layer that I kind of put in for the kids to kind of, you know, you can. And if you log, you create an account, and you log into their site, they have some pretty interesting security controls as well that you can add. I do it at the router level. And so I just log into my wireless router and I set the default DNS on that to that IP address. So go out to, if you're interested in more information about how to set it up, they got great tutorials over there. OpenDNS.com will get you there and they can walk it through. If they want to check out Google, if they would need instructions on how to set that up for Google,
You can just go to Google site and search and it'll.
Yeah, or maybe just search Google DNS.
Yeah, or just go to your TCP/IP config settings for your DNS and put in 8888.
Right.
What I need to find is that software and put it in the show notes so you can test it yourself, because what's fastest from my house may not be fastest for somebody else.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. We talked about that with Gordon Schmidt a little while back ago. It's called NameBench, the piece of software, and it's the one where you run it on your PC and it looks at all the various DNS servers that your network knows about and picks the fastest one. Is that right?
Yeah. So it's already in one of the show notes, I'm sure.
Well, we'll throw it back in there again.
Yeah, I'm trying to just find out which show we did it in. But, yeah, we talked about it with Gordon, I think.
Christian, from your experience, how often would the results of that DNS change, that speed change? If you ran it, do you need to run that once every 6 months, once a year? I mean, what's been your experience?
I'd say if you get one good benchmark, you're all right. For some people, it'll be more of a change than others, like, I was doing some DNS testing for one of my clients today out of a remote desktop window, and man, nothing would resolve within a reasonable time. I was running some queries and some telnets, and it was just like, what am I waiting for here, people? So I changed it over to Google DNS, and bam, everything was
really
fine. So yeah, I think with your lower end internet service providers, so people who are still on DSL or the lower end bandwidth spectrum benefit from it more, and then the more bandwidth you get, the less of an issue it becomes because you have more bandwidth to reach farther away DNS servers quicker. So it's kind of a toss up, but I definitely say no matter what your bandwidth is, go ahead and run that tool.
Okay. All right, good stuff. Well, does Google offer any kind of filtering or protection, or I mean, is it just straight DNS?
Yeah, I'm not sure, to be honest, but I would have thought
Google would be more interested in metrics.
Yeah, but I use it for straight DNS. You know, for me, I'm not really in it for the filtering.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, when you have four boys, you know, you care a little bit about what they're
absolutely
where they're going on the web. So it's as a father of four and having all these PCs in the house, the other layer of security we used is K9 internet, security protection, and that's been very efficient too. That blocks ads and blocks a lot of questionable content. If I need to really lock things down, K9 does it well and filters it well. I've really started removing it. As the kids have gotten older though, now I'm kind of leaving it up to them and I've been pulling that stuff off. So just some security options.
So that's something you put on their PC?
It's a client.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so there are different levels of security. So I don't put it – it just slows me down way too much. So I don't put it on any of my PCs. But
you don't want to filter yourself.
Oh, that's right. They'd probably filter the average guy at TV, you know. That's because of our questionable content. But Sarah likes it. My wife likes it on her laptop. She wants it. So I end up putting that back on every time we're or doing something. So, well, speaking of not wanting something, Mike, you've had an issue with Skype as of late, and you reminded me of that several times. Andrew, you had mentioned here in the show notes that Skype is now integrating with your home phone. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, over on the Skype blog, I was looking at something the other day over there, and this one caught my eye. There's a crowd that Skype are doing some work with at the moment called Free Talk, who have a phone adapter, so you can use your existing handset to make Skype to Skype calls, as well as Skype out calls. So I thought that was kind of interesting. They're sort of taking that VoIP thing back into, or bringing the VoIP back into the mainstream as well.
Yeah, well, it's just a VoIP adapter using Skype Skype out, right?
Mike, yeah, so it's just a regular ATA, except you're using Skype instead of your usual provider.
Mike, are you going to switch over to your home as well so that you can use Skype?
No, you know, I have a special sweet deal from T-Mobile where our VoIP is through a little T-Mobile box that's like $9.99 a month for unlimited long distance and local, and I'm going to stick with that.
Okay, and this deal here on Skype, it looks like it's $40. Is that right? It Free Talk connects me and more 60 minutes of complimentary calls to landlines and mobiles, because you have to pay on Skype if you're going Skype to landline, right?
Yeah.
And so 60 minutes of it for at least here it says for $40. So it's not free.
No, it's not a free, but if you'd made a lot of Skype to Skype, like for example, if I wanted to talk to you on a regular phone rather than have a PC around.
Yeah.
That'd be a reasonable option.
Yeah. And it only handles regular phones, so you're not going to plug anything else into this thing to be able to see video. It's going to make audio calls for you.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And so if I want to call you on Skype, it's going to be free.
Yep.
Right? Okay. Good stuff. And Mike, what's your issue with Skype, man? You've been hammering on it for a couple days now. What have you seen in Skype over the last couple weeks that kind of bothers you?
Well, the first thing that bothered me was when it did the auto update. When I was in the middle of a conversation, it started updating. And I thought, okay, maybe I clicked on something wrong and I initiated it. But a couple of days later, I was on with somebody else, and two people on the call, I had a number of people on it, two people on the call had it happen to them while they were talking.
Right in the middle of the conversation.
Right in the middle of the conversation. Uh-huh. All of a sudden, they jumped out. And I had no idea why, and I found out later that it was doing some kind of update, and it forced them into it. So after you get that in there, you reboot, which you know I'm anti-reboot, but you know you reboot, and comes back. I've had some stability issues. I also don't like the way the screen is. You know, I don't think we had the same screen layout options that we had.
No,
before.
They did. They did change it. It's a whole new UI, so to speak.
Yeah, and I think it's worse. I don't like it.
Becoming Microsoft Office, isn't it?
Say that again, Andrew. You were breaking up a little bit.
It's becoming a little bit Microsoftized.
Yeah,
really. I mean, the buttons are getting a bit rounder and
bigger.
Well, it's getting a little bit softer in its look.
When we have multiple people on, like we do right now, it's actually not that bad. But whenever what I was running into is when you have just one other person on. Right. So what I couldn't figure out. So I had one other person on, and their video was big. And my video was a smaller thumbnail overlapping their video.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't care to see myself on the call, but it was overlapping their video and I didn't like that. And I could not figure out how to move them or change them or do anything to me, but I could make myself really small and then that would fix it. But you're just more limited. I think once you got multiple people on, it's not that bad.
Here's the annoying thing, though, that I found with it. Well, one, they put the Skype logo in it now up in the upper right-hand corner. And
get rid of that.
Well, you can, but the video won't go over it. And you know what that's for? That's because broadcast networks have started using Skype as their way of bringing in correspondents from all over the world. So this gives that huge Skype watermark, right, so to speak. Mm-hmm. What's been really bad is, okay, like we're in the view now. I'll show this live here in the video. You won't be able to see it if you're listening, of course. But if I reduce the size of the window down, say I want to make it smaller, what happens is that the video icon, the audio icon, the plus icon, and the phone will actually cover you guys up from a picture standpoint.
Yeah, that's horrible.
Right. So as I'm reducing that down now, you can see in the video, if you're watching on video audio, you just have to trust me, that I can't see anymore. I have to actually blow that screen out, and then you guys are not covered up from it. So it doesn't scale real well from once it gets to a certain size, that those icons will cover up the bottom pictures. That just kind of drives me nuts as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I showed folks that I think the version I'm on now is 1.113. Andrew, you said you were pushed an auto update today. That was 1.15.
Yeah, that's right. I went up to 1.5. Yeah. 1.15 rather.
So it does seem like Microsoft is taking some efforts to really move forward on this platform of sort, but boy, they are. It's causing some problems, especially for guys like us that use it every day. Christian, have you had any issues with Skype in the stuff that you're doing?
No, I didn't upgrade to 5.5. I've been fine. And,
you tricky little guy.
Yes, and what's interesting too is like the new. I despise the new bar.
Okay.
Where the heck did the screen sharing button go on the new bar?
Yeah.
Fail.
Exactly.
There's fail number one.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, where is that?
You're right. It's gone.
I do that all the time with my mom when she can't figure out how to do something.
Yeah. You got to go into the tools now.
Oh, yeah. She'll never figure that out.
Fail number two is reading the blog post from our dear friend Mike Bartlett, who's the Windows product manager for Skype. I'm just going to read this to you guys. We are pleased to announce that Skype 5.5 for Windows is now available for download. Based on user feedback, we've made some updates from the beta version for Windows, which launched in June, and we wished it never launched. The Skype 5.5 update comes with deeper Facebook integration without having to leave Skype. You can check your Facebook, friends online, instant message, Facebook contact groups, view and update your Facebook status. It sounds like they want to buy Facebook. We also made a number of updates that make your Skype calls on Windows even better. We've improved the controls for videos and group video calls. No, you did not improve the controls. Enhanced video call reliability, questionable, and made several design changes to improve your overall Skype experience. Probably the major design change was having the Skype watermark in the top left corner or top right corner.
Right.
Great improvement. Plus, for all your
emoticons.
Emoticon, thank you. Emoticon fanatics. No, the Skype, I can never say this. Emoticons have received an update with smoother animations that stand out. We're also introducing a few new Skype emoticons to use when the words fail you. So download it now. Why do I want to download this now? And what's also scary additionally is just to come to the blog page and you scroll down and you see this guy with this really forced smile like, I love Skype 5.5. And the lady's on the other end like, but take a look at that link at the top. It'll be up in the show notes. It's really questionable. I have no problems with, let's see, what am I on right now? I'm on dear old Skype 5.3. It's rock solid. And
no way to go back at this point. You can see if you're watching the video, I opened the chat window, and all that did was took those videos of you, Mike, and you, Andrew, and it hid them behind the toolbar.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, poor Skype.
Yeah. Even for me, the sidebar, so you got your video you can see there of us, the video. To the left of that would be your contacts. And it used to be you can click on a little arrow and get rid of that and be full screen in your window, not full screen. And I don't even see how to do that anymore.
Yeah,
you
know,
drag, make it smaller, but how do I get rid of it completely?
They took out the controls on the top too, right? Remember it used to say normal view and dynamic view, and you could click on those and change the way it was. That's gone. You know,
well, you still have you still have that. That's a far right button. You have something that says normal view.
Far right on the bottom, or it says screen options for this call. Oh, I see. Oh, I thought that was just to pop out. If you can pop out the picture, which is kind of cool. Here, I'll drag this into the camera view so you can see it. But there's a little pop out there that will allow you to create. This pop out is more Google esque. Because it only shows the person that's talking.
That's cool.
Right.
Because you can drag that onto a different monitor, and if you're in a multi-monitor setup, and just look at the one that you...
Yeah. Well, you know, Mike, from a podcasting perspective, right, you and I could take this I could take, if I didn't want, you know, because currently on the podcast, we show everybody talking at the same time.
Right.
And this pop-out is just whoever's talking. So I could drag this over. Here, we'll do this just live while people are watching.
You can't resize that little window, though, which I wish you could do. How hard would that be? I mean, all you got to do is add a little control to it to make that resize.
Yeah.
And they won't let you do that.
Well, and then you know what? The green controls for Skype actually get hidden behind the picture when you're, you know how you size it and you like it to stay over the top of it?
Yeah.
But it won't. It goes in behind it. So you can't actually tell where that, where the camera is. Anyways, I guess the point is Skype, Microsoft, stop. Stop fixing what's not broken.
One interesting thing I've just seen with the pop-out window, though, is if you put it on top of another active window, if you're running multiple monitors, it stays on top of everything.
Yeah,
so I'm running multiple screens, and I've just popped you on top of a different one that's got something else running on it, and I can still keep going on that screen, but your window stays on top.
Yeah,
which is kind of neat.
Yeah, well, that's the on top always is what stops me from being able to see in Procaster, from being able to see the video pieces, right? Because it's always going to go behind it, showing where what area of the screen that I'm showing.
Yeah,
and that looks similar to what they're doing with Facebook, that little pop-out window. If you've used it on Facebook, it looks similar to that.
Mm. And it might just be that same control.
Yeah.
You know, so anyways, some topics, some discussion around Skype. Mike, I know that you've just been riding Skype as of late. And so
I hate to jinx this, and you don't believe there's a thing as that.
I don't believe in jinx.
So I can go ahead and say it on your show.
Yeah, go ahead.
But so far tonight is actually doing pretty good.
It's very good. The video, with the exception of Andrew, the video has been in sync most of the night. And Andrew, I think it's just latency for you.
Yeah.
I think it's my haircut.
It is.
You're more aerodynamic tonight.
I like it indeed. Christian, go ahead, Christian.
Have you guys had any are we going to jump in?
Let's jump into Christian's Corner.
All right, sounds like a plan. All right, so to append to the Skype discussion, have you guys had the Facebook video integrate for you guys yet?
Yes.
Because it just kind of showed up randomly one day on mine. So.
Yes, a couple weeks now.
I haven't had it.
Really?
Interesting. I don't think so.
You might check, Mike. I thought that rolled out to everybody. You might just not know you have it.
What's interesting, too, is that I can't tell. Is this part? Does this connect with Skype, or is this a separate video service?
No, it's a little. If you don't have Skype, they'll ask you to download a little component that is a little Skype component. But okay. I think if you already have Skype, I think it hooks just right into it.
Right. So, I mean, even I'm still on Skype 5.3 and it works, so.
Yeah. So, Mike, let's see if you
check. Is that the thing that says start a video call?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, okay, so I do have it.
Yeah, and actually video on Facebook is really good, surprisingly.
Now, what happens if we press...
excited about that.
Yeah,
What happens if we press it right now?
Oh, no, don't invoke the Skype gods.
I won't do that.
Yeah, no, but serious, I was very surprised how good the quality of the call was when I've done video chat on Facebook. I don't do a lot of it, but and I think it's only point to point. I'd have to double check.
I don't think I've even got it yet, the Facebook video.
It's not very obvious. I think
very low scale rollout.
What I had to do in order to see it is actually click on a person.
Yeah, exactly. It didn't even tell me to activate it. I just saw it one day.
Yeah. You know what? I just clicked on a different person and now I don't have it.
I'm looking at you now, Mike. Where would I see it?
Andrew, I got video. Start a video call with you.
So what happens when I click on a person? Up in the upper right hand corner, it normally says message and poke.
Huh.
I never knew what poke was, but you know.
I've only got message and poke.
And if you have the video call, it will say video call. And I've clicked on three people so far, Jim, and only one of them did it say video call.
Yeah. Well, Andrew, I see video call for you. Mike, you said it's rolling out, right?
Yeah.
Let's look at you. So, Mike, I see it for you. Christian Johnson, no video for you, Christian.
No video for you. It's kind of like a Seinfeld episode, this.
So what it was, from that, I take it that both you and the other person have had to have it roll out to them. And they probably have had to download that little thing if they don't have Skype already.
Christian, have you done that yet?
What's that?
On Facebook, have you downloaded or enabled the little video capabilities?
I didn't touch anything. It just showed up one day.
Oh, but you have you have tried it?
No.
Oh. Yeah, because I can't see video for you. That's interesting.
That's a shame.
All right. Well, that's okay. Yeah. Not like we're going to use Facebook for... Although that would be interesting.
I do have it for you. I do have it for you.
Yeah.
Jim.
Well, keep... Yeah, you should. Yeah. Keep going, Christian.
All right. So from Christian's desk, this is my massive IT headache of the week. Andrew got a bit of a taste of it last night as things were degrading rapidly. So... this begins from a client issue where this is a music school that maybe sends about, they have the student and faculty mailing list, right? So there can be anywhere from 300 to, 350 some recipients on any one mail. And when I signed the mail over to IX Web Hosting and spent the time and money to have those transferred, I was under the impression that it was going to be the unlimited storage space that I have on IX Web Hosting for mail. Storage-wise, there was unlimited for mail, but when you send, because it's shared hosting, there are restrictions that were A, never defined in the contract I have with them, or B, never defined in their terms of service. So I called IX Web Hosting, I spoke to their technical representative for that account, his manager, the system administrator for that server, and the customer relations manager. And none of them were able to whitelist that domain because they have a cap where you cannot send more than 25 recipients per email, which is a bit low for a company or a group that needs to send out to their students and faculty. So I'm sitting here
which is an anti-spam feature, right?
Right, which is designed to... curb spam, because what happens is if they start getting mass mail spammers on their server,
the whole domain will get blacklisted, right?
Well, IX Web Hosting is the domain and IP that gets blacklisted, not the client. So they kept that. They used to be able to whitelist that domain, and they changed their security policy, so they wouldn't do anything. So I'm thinking, all right, great. So about a week goes by, they start getting a bit antsy, and I'm thinking, all right, I got to do something. So I try and teach them how to use a mailing list called the Enslin Mailing Program, where if you set up a mailing list, there's no limit on the recipients. You set up the mailing list for however many people you have, and then you send it to like students at or whatever you want your mailing list name to be, and then it sends it to everyone on that list. Well, with IX Web Hosting, you can only add to that mailing list if you have access to the control panel. So that didn't really work so well. And even with trying to subscribe and unsubscribe from an email address, it's just a headache. I couldn't even read the language that was coming back and forth. It was pretty much impossible. So I'm like, all right, that's not going to work. My next idea, about another week later, was, all right, I'm going to edit their webmail interface to automatically chop up their lists into 25 at a time. So if they paste more than 25, it's just going to automatically cut them up and send them out. That just didn't work so well, because every time you chop it up, it adds another number to your daily limit, and it just gets really ugly really quick. So that didn't really work so well, especially because many of these people are using Outlook and Apple Mail and their client software, and they were too troubled to use the webmail. So I'm sitting here thinking, gee, I've exhausted all my options. I either resign this client or I spend the time and money again to move them to a mass mailing company. And I'm thinking there has to be another way. So last night, I started setting up an IIS SMTP server, which is Windows default web hosting service and mailing service that they have in Windows XP Professional, Vista Ultimate in Business, 7 Ultimate, and your server technologies. So I set that up. Come to find out, it wouldn't resolve or send mail to any server, because what happens is You can set up the DNS right. You can set up the SMTP right. You can even get your ports right if it's not part of 25. But because your IP is seen as either, A, it's going to be seen as residential, but most importantly, your IP itself is not seen as like a node for ISP. It's not basically accredited. They have no idea what this IP is and where it's coming from. So your mail pretty much gets rejected from every single server. And even if it's set up completely right, every single mail server you try and send to with your own makeshift IIS server will can your email and it will never get delivered. And that's true for even, you'll see programs out on Google that say free SMTP server where you type in localhost and you're outgoing for Outlook and it tries to shoot them. But it really just, you're going to blacklist your IP address. You're going to end up with even more problems than you started with. And the servers aren't going to accept the mail anyway. So then I had a revelation of trying to get the smart host to work. And the smart host is a special term which says when the mail comes to the IIS web server, it basically just says, you're the smart host, you try and send the email first. So I typed in my Verizon email account as a test, and what do you know, mail starts going out. So I think, all right, maybe this is a solution. I could set up an IIS box over at the building and get it up, and we'd be good. Come to find out, Verizon, Gmail, and pretty much every single ISP email provider has SMTP caps. The highest free email provider has a limitation, which is Gmail, Google Apps, which is what the average guy uses, has a limitation of 100 recipients and 500 emails a day. So even that wasn't going to work.
You know,
so
Christian, I have a business account over, you know, for this user group that I use, right, set up just like theaverageguy.tv. And we've sent out as many as 400 emails from that account all in one.
Right. Because the caveat with that is Google Webmail interface lets you send up to 500 recipients.
Oh.
But if you try and send it from an Outlook client or a Thunderbird client, it's only 100.
Well, that makes more sense. I'm glad you clarified that because I didn't know what the limit was. And I just had my email. You know, I've got a gal who helps me with the user group, and her job is to do the mailing lists and all the mailing, and we had no idea what the caps were. And so she just one day, you know, kind of copied all 400 addresses and put them in the thing and then kind of closed her eyes and click send, and it worked.
Yeah.
And we were stunned. So 500 from the webmail, that's good to know. That's really good to know as we grow.
Yeah, and one of my points for the average guy is if you have an email account, go on the internet and find out what your SMTP limits, because you could be sending mail and some servers do and some servers don't tell you if it gets bounced or not when you have too many recipients. Mm. So go check that out, because you don't want your email account getting suspended or otherwise because you didn't look at those limits. So I was at the point where, like, all right, even if I use this great Google Apps and I put my account in, I'm still up a creek without a paddle on the recipients and the 500 a day, because they'll blow through that like nothing. Finally, this morning, I was thinking, what if I do some Google searching for the words SMTP mail relay server? Now, you think, what does that mean? That just means it's an ISP service provider that specializes in only sending out emails. This is commonly used for mass mailing, mass market mail, that nature of stuff. So it's not like you're creating your inboxes and you're not creating mail accounts with these kinds of services. The only thing it does is it sends out your email. So the great thing about this was if I can find an SMTP service that's reasonably affordable, then I can have them be sending out as much as they want to as many recipients. And we don't have to move the emails again. It'll stay at IX Web Hosting. Their synchronized IMAP will still be working. So I'm thinking, all right, now I'm on the right track. I was looking around, and everything was geared towards mass marketing, mm-hmm. $39.99 a month, all this. And I'm sitting here going.
So you ran into like Strong Mail and Cheetah Mail and some of those services that specialize in mass email marketing.
Yeah, I'm sitting here going, this is just not right. Finally, it must have either been the bottom of the second or third page. Maybe it was in the first page, but I went to SendGrid.com, and I'm thinking, yeah, it's just going to be another crappy site. Come to the pricing page. They have five pricing options. The higher-end ones were like 400 a month for like 750,000 emails a month. Then it was like 300,000, 100,000. You get all the way down the ladder, they have the Golden Horde package for what I was looking for. It's called their Light package. And all it is unlimited recipients, unlimited mail sent. You get your entire tools for monitoring who is sending what kind of emails, you know, your quota, message delivered, messages rejected. And the pricing was 10 cents for 1,000 emails sent.
Well, that's
so
not bad.
They would have to send 10,000 emails to incur a $1 monthly charge. And for a business
that's
like this,
respectable.
And a business like this that sends out maybe to their 300 student mailing list two or three times a week, you know, we're looking at maybe sending 4,000 or 5,000 messages a month and paying 50 cents for it. And I'm like,
that's not a bad price.
So why pay $10 a month? Why worry about getting your account suspended? Why worry about the message not going through to your service provider and getting blacklisted when you can pay 10 cents for 1,000?
So that'd be a pretty good small business solution then for folks who who are sending out between, you know, probably they're sending out 1,000 to 10,000 emails on their lists, and you know, it gets a couple bucks every time they do it, which is pretty reasonable, you think?
Right. And and again, like I must have called every single 1-800 number that mass mailing is known to man, and I think maybe the closest reasonable thing I heard was GoDaddy had, like, you could get 20 email accounts. It was like either $3.50 or $7 a month or something like that, and you got 20 accounts. But even GoDaddy's unlimited email plan was restricted to 250 recipients if you're using something like Outlook or Thunderbird.
Yeah.
So this is great because, A, my emails are already included on the IX web hosting plan that I had for them a long time ago, so they're already getting their unlimited storage and their IMAP synchronization between all their devices. And then with this, I can even add other small businesses to this account as time goes on and just divvy up their monthly fees or whatever. But I mean, for a small business that maybe sends out a max of 5,000 messages per month, sure, pay 50 cents. Why pay $10 a month for something you're not going to use?
Yeah. Oh,
get alone the fact with this, you can send out from as many different email accounts as you want as long as they're already set up on a different IMAP server. So, I mean, it's not like you're just restricted to whatever domain. This is why you can add on other clients and such because
Christian, this allows Outlook integration then, right? So I can send these 10,000 out from an Outlook client.
Right.
I don't have to log into their web. Their webmail.
Yeah.
I can set it up and send it from Outlook. Oh, that's very cool.
So you change your outgoing SMTP server to the SendGrid. And the one mistake I was making was I was still thinking I needed that IIS server. I was trying to relay it to the SendGrid. You can just completely get rid
straight
of that.
Straight through.
Put it straight through. Wow. Put your username and password for your account properties into the SMTP authentication grid, and you are set. And I would pay the 50 cents a month fee if it meant that I didn't have to get a phone call from them saying, why doesn't my email work? How do I set up mass mailing? Where's my address book located?
Set that up as a service, right?
Yeah.
And charge them, you know, $5 or $10 a month.
When I first went to the page, I'm thinking, this has got to be the biggest scam ever. So I was going, all right, I'm just going to call and see whatever. The sales rep knew what she was talking about, technically and sales-wise. She was a knowledgeable person. She forwarded me to the guy who knew everything about the IIS when I was trying to set it up, even though I didn't need it. But very helpful. And even the administration panel, I can see who's sending out what and what their statistics are and what their average rate of send is. It's like Google Analytics for SMTP.
What's the name of that again, Christian?
SendGrid.com.
Okay.
And that equals fantastic.
Very cool. Check that out. A good small business solution like a church or a soccer club. Well, soccer clubs maybe are small enough. But anytime you have more than probably 200, right, if you're struggling to send out more than 200 emails at a time, and this might be a cost-effective way to do it. All right, deal of the week.
I wanted to cover my Intel RAID build up at the house, we added another 10 terabytes of dedicated storage to get to
that's
a total.
Sick.
To get to a total.
That is the sickest. That's the sickest pain. Sentence I've ever heard you say.
Another 10 terabytes. So what does that bring it up to?
A grand total of 34 terabytes.
Oh, my God.
Okay, what are you catching? You're catching up to mom. Chat with that much storage.
Yeah. So, all right.
Say
so,
that again, Mike. I'm sorry.
What
Mike.
Are you storing on there?
What do we got? We got our media center box, which has the quad Cton tuner card, so every show record gets streamed out to the computers. We got our subsonic music library of 25,000 MP3s. We got our movies on there. We got our pictures on there. We got our documents on there. We got SharePoint stuff. We got everything you can imagine.
I'm going to go on the record and say Gary's doing it because he can.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
I funded it.
Really?
Let's just get that clear.
Nice.
I made Gary's day, but so yeah, that was a lot of fun, and we had a good time with that.
Yeah.
So we came down to two. We were looking for affordable fast RAID, and the two options we came down to is the Intel, one of the later Intel RAID cards with 512 megs of RAM and has two SAS ports. And that was like $450, and that was 10% off when we bought it. And the Archaea card, which is pretty much the equivalent for the Archaea brand. So we went with the Intel only because the cache memory was 512 instead of 256, although now after running the test, we think that the Archaea may have been faster for the Samsung drive. So we bought 8 Samsung F4 2-terabyte drives, $80 a pop, why not?
Sure.
So it was about a total of 800 to get the 8 2-terabyte drives and the RAID controller. We popped that into a Server 2008 data center, and we set up RAID 50. Great advantages to RAID 50 is that it has both parity and striping. So it takes two groups of 4 2-terabyte hard drives on each side. This is a RAID 5, this is a RAID 5, and this is parity. So the sectors are being matched in case a drive were to fall offline. You could replace the drive and you'd have your drives back online without losing data. And then there is a RAID 0 stripe that binds these two RAID 5 systems together, so you get both speed and redundancy. So with RAID 50, you can get the speed close of what RAID 0 offers and the redundancy of RAID 5. So in this setup with RAID 50, you can lose, I want to say it's RAID 60 that lets you lose 2 hard drives and it can reconstruct the data. RAID 50, I believe, is 1 and 2 under certain circumstances. So that was pretty neat. And we're getting about 350 megabytes per second read-write over our network.
Good gosh.
Which is not bad.
That's like SSD speed.
Yeah. So, which isn't bad, but we were going to try and get it up to
which
600.
Isn't bad. Listen, that's not bad, but.
Right. But with the Archaea, we think we could probably double that. So our next card that we buy, we're going to try it with the Archaea and build another RAID. So the great thing about this is that.
This is not an average guy purchase, by the way.
So are you streaming movies to all your neighbors at the same time?
They're trying.
Oh, yeah. Here, this is what's great. So
saving the neighborhood.
It's our original dilemma was that we had Server 2011, Windows Home Server 2011, and Windows Home Server version 1, we were kind of doing different things to kind of duplicate our backups, make sure if something went dead that we'd have something. With the RAID, it's you get your stuff on there. If a hard drive fails, go buy a new one and put it in, and you're back right up where you are. So you don't have to worry about backing up the RAID that much. So what we did is we put all our main media files right on the RAID, and then you tell Subsonic to point to the RAID, you should see how fast Subsonic can load your music and your videos when it's on a 350 megabit per second RAID storage. I mean, it is lightning quick. You can be running Blu-rays over to your neighbor in China, and it's just crystal clear. It comes right up, and so we've been doing that for our remote streaming. I got a couple college buds who record their shows through us and watch them out there. And, you know, college dorms, they get okay speed, and they're not having problems. So it was a great solution for redundancy, for speed, for remote. So if you're – all right. Now, this is like the crazy Johnson family rendition of the deal of the week. If you want to start on a lower-end RAID system, I recommend going out, buy two Samsung F4s. That's going to give you 4 terabytes. It's going to cost you $160. And see if your motherboard that you already have has onboard RAID. If not, start out with one of these entry-level $100, $200 RAID controllers and, you know, start learning the different RAID. What do you want more? Do you want speed or do you want redundancy? So I think if you stick with the F4 drives and you pick a RAID controller or use your onboard that you like, you're going to get a nice combination of entry-level RAID performance and kind of see how server technology can work right in your desktop and get that same performance if you're more of a home user. So that was a pretty cool digital project. Nice. I'm hoping to get pictures up.
Yeah, you should do a write-up with pictures and everything. That'd be awesome.
The box is incredibly heavy now with the 9 drives in it. So so now we have the RAID has the 8 2-terabyte drives. Then there's an OS drive that's another 2 terabytes. Then our MediaSmart server has 2 3-terabyte drives in it and 2 2-terabyte drives in it, I want to say. And then our other home server box has, I think, 4 or 5 2-terabyte drives.
It does highlight the fact – just a second, Mike. Sorry to cut you off. It does highlight the fact of how cheap storage is from a drive perspective, because that's a lot of storage and it's less than $1,000. I mean that 5 years ago would have been $10,000.
Yeah.
You know, and, Mike, I cut you off. Go ahead. Sorry.
So for RAID 50, I take it you need a minimum of 7 drives?
6.
Minimum of 6.
But don't you have the one stripe through? Is that a separate drive?
No, that just happens the controller takes.
Oh, two. Okay. So minimum of 6.
Right. So normally with your onboard motherboards, they normally support 0 and 1 by default. Some onboard will do 5 and 10. You really need to buy a separate controller if you're going to try 50 or 60. With 60. I believe it's a minimum of 4 and 4. With 50, it's 3 and 3. So you can still run RAID 50 and have 4 and 4 or 5 and 5 or 10 and 10, whatever you want to do. And with this RAID controller, even though there's only 2 SAS ports, so the normal expansion model is 1 SAS port has a cord that divvies up 4 SATA drives, you can get expanders, and I think you can expand, at least on our card, you can expand it up to 32 drives on per controller. So.
Wowza. Yeah. Andrew, are you seeing – is that kind of what you're – yeah, Mike's showing in the video the cable there. I got exactly, a black one of those. Is that – what in the enterprise, you seen a lot of that?
Most of what we do at the moment is in the SAN, so typically it's just RAID 5, I think.
Okay.
RAID 6 is the one that probably interests me if I was going to go down that path purely from performance and redundancy. But that's when you really start talking some serious disk. I mean, you need a minimum of 8 disks to do RAID 6.
Okay.
Or RAID 6.0.
60. RAID 60 is what you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And then you got, you know, RAID 6 plus 1 as well, which is in which then reverses your stripe the other way.
Yeah, and we were going that's back and crazy. Forth. Well, do we want RAID 60 or 50? RAID 6 gets really great redundancy but doesn't get the speed that RAID 50 has. And RAID 60 is much better in speed. It's still not as quick as RAID 50. So
where's the performance bottleneck in the system now if you were going to have one, Christian? Would it be the network?
No, because that's the thing. If the hard drives can run at 350 megabits per second, then that's still within our gigabit LAN saturation. So
yeah, okay.
So it's still I.O.
Yeah.
Right?
So, I mean, right now we can transfer if you're connecting directly to the RAID from a different computer, you will get that 350 per second when copying and pasting. So, like, even for me, it's faster to copy and save files right to the RAID instead of my desktop. But, yeah, I know, right? But, like, so in the normal case, so if you're not saving right to the RAID, you get the speed that your personal hard drive has. So like this hard drive, I want to say, gets around 100 or 120. So I'll get exactly that speed going out.
That is amazing, because I don't think I've ever heard that it's faster to save across the network than it is to save locally.
Yep.
And I guess without an SSD, I mean, even at 350, you're exceeding some SSDs.
Right. And what's great is that you don't have the lifetime issues of so many read-writes of SSDs, and you got the redundancy. If a drive fails, stick a new $80 F4 in and call it a night.
Wow.
Yep. So that's how you get crazy.
So if you ran your PC with an SSD drive in it as an OS drive and then used your RAID as attached storage across the network, I mean, mm-hmm. you really would just have blazing speed at that point.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's sick. So,
yeah, if I put a SSD in it,
I hate you, Christian.
So, I mean, even if I buy like a cheapo 64-gigabyte SSD and throw it in here as an OS drive, then I could copy directly on my network at 350 megabits per second. Yeah. Which, if you're going over wireless N, you would go past the limits of wireless N, because wireless N you get up to 300. So we're coming just a bit past that, but most of our stuff is gigabit. So
yeah, and wireless isn't that as compared to wired. The wireless is not a solid state as far as making sure that data is moving as fast. I mean, it has bursts that are that fast, but from a steady state, mm-hmm. I haven't seen that kind of speeds on wireless stay consistent as you're trying to copy.
Right.
Data. People get real frustrated with that. The average guy gets really frustrated with that when they get on wireless and they think, oh, this is great. I'm going to make my whole house wireless. And then you try and transfer something and you're like, God, why is this so slow? You know, this should be 54 or 108 or whatever, right? And it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so definitely. Christian, I'm going to have you hold your tip of the week. We got Mike on here, and we've run a little long, and I do want to get some of his stuff in. So hold that tip.
Good.
If got a few minutes at the end, we may cover it. But Mike, you've got this photography podcast. By the way, thanks, Christian. That was dynamite.
That was awesome, Christian.
Yeah, that was really good. A little above the average guy, but I think I think in the future we're going to see those kinds of speeds. It's just going to get faster, so very cool. Appreciate it. Mike, of course, you're doing the photography podcast. It's kind of driven you back into some photography usage. You're trying to get out more and take more pictures, and that's forcing you to use your PCs more from a photography perspective. You and I had talked about you trying to have a segment each week when you're on.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because I tried to get you to show some photos, and you're like, no, there's some interesting technology around photography. So talk a little bit about what you found.
Yeah, let me go over one real fast that I think have a sound effect that you'll like.
Okay.
So this, if you can see, and this is my Nikon D2H. It's an older camera. It's a little old. Now, I want you to be able to hear it. So hold on.
Oh, love that sound.
Did you hear how fast that went?
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah. That is eight frames a second. Now, this is an older camera, so 8 frames a second is pretty impressive. But Sony just came out with a 12 frame per second camera, DSLR. And, I'm a big Nikon guy. That's a Nikon, and I recommend buying Nikon or Canon. But Sony is a real strong competitor. Just came out with a 12 frame per second camera that is, on top of that, it is a 24-megapixel camera, which that is unbelievable. They're able to push that through there. That much data. 24
megapixels every frame.
24 megapixels at 12 frames per second.
Yeah. Wow.
Now, if you heard that big noise that mine was making, what that is it's a mirror in there that's flapping. And that's what's making that sound. The way they're able to achieve this is they have a translucent mirror that light passes through it, so they don't have anything going up and down. And there's some disadvantages and advantages to that. One of the advantages is these crazy fast shutter speeds.
And that can only get faster, right? I mean, but with that
sure.
Technology.
I think that the problem I think a lot of these guys have always faced is the buffer. Storing that much data and sending that much data to the card and doing all that stuff.
You take 2 seconds of pictures and your card's full.
Right. Yeah, or your memory buffer's full, waiting on the card to free up to write more data to it. Yeah. The other problem is I don't know what the theoretical limit on how fast you can flip that mirror up and down. I mean, that's, I think they've got the newest Nikon of the same model class. This is the sports camera. Is now 9 frames per second, which is pretty fast. I mean, 8 frames per second sounded pretty impressive, and it is pretty impressive.
Yeah, do that again. We want to hear that again.
Yeah.
Pull that out. Yeah, hold that.
I got to get good light because I have to have light.
Really? Okay. Yeah, let's hear it.
Wait, hold up.
Nice. I like it.
The problem, of course, to get fast, things like that, you have to have light. So if it's right. if it's too dark, it won't be able to go fast.
Oh, so it's sensing what the light is available there, and it only goes as fast as it can support from a light perspective.
So so if you're taking 8 frames per second, there has to be enough light that your exposure is not shorter than that.
Okay,
or longer than that, I should say. If your exposure is longer than that, then it can't do that fast. So in this dark room, that was a little bit of a challenge.
But it knows. It auto-adjusts for you and only lets
right,
you go
fast. Right, because the mode I have it switched into. Okay.
All right.
The other thing I was going to talk about.
Hold on, one more question on that. What's the price of this camera that does 12 shots, 12 frames per second?
The Sony one, I thought it was around $2,000.
Huh.
Which, I'm trying to find it now. In that class, that's not bad. You know, the new one that replaces the one I have here goes for about $5,400.
Okay.
So that's not, it's really not it's not a professional grade camera, but you know, what makes a camera professional is the guy behind it, girl behind it, not the camera.
Right. Andrew, you were taking some photos at one point. Have you?
I still do.
Yeah, do you?
Yeah. I just don't share them as. Some people do.
Yeah.
And I don't take as many as I'd like to.
What kind of camera do you have, or what kind of camera do you use?
I've got a Canon EOS 40D. So I think when mine's in full rock and roll mode, it does about 6.5 frames a second.
Okay. And is that enough for you?
It's very similar. It's faster than I need, almost, yeah.
The only time when I really need that kind of speed is, you know, shooting sports. Like if I'm trying to take a person batting a ball, it is incredibly difficult to get the bat on the ball.
Mm.
You know, that swing through there, even at 8 frames per second, and I can time it. I can tell by their look that they're about to swing, and I just hit the shutter and just start banging it out at 8 frames per second. And odds are, 9 times out of 10, I'm not going to get the ball, you know, bat on ball.
Wow.
It's going to be slightly off. So, you know, I don't know where that sweet spot is where you can get it, maybe 12 frames per second set. But, you know, some of that, you know, 8 frames per second just won't do it all for you. You got to get a technique down to actually try and get the bat on ball with your 8 frames per second.
Yeah, but just I need that sound effect on my Android phone. You take a picture just automatically. There's something, I don't know what that is. There's something cool about that sound.
When you're out at a sporting event and you're taking pictures and people hear that go off, everybody turns their head to look at that. What was that?
It's impressive. It's
not loud. Now you won't get that sound with the Sony because there's no mirror flipping up.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. Do they digitally add this? You know, it would be like them to add the sound in that even though it's not doing anything because no guys miss that stuff, right? I mean you want that click when you're on the problem with a camera phone is you oftentimes don't get the click knowing you've taken the picture.
Yeah, and that's what it is, feedback, knowing you got the picture.
Right, yeah. And so that would be, I think that would be, they would want to add in. Somebody said there were some of the first tests with electric cars that they did, they were so quiet that they had actually put speakers in the front of the engine and simulate an engine sound so people could hear the car coming up behind them, right, or whatever. Yeah. People, it just didn't feel right to not have, you know, so... Maybe something similar there. They'll just simulate the camera or the shutter to make it sound like it's doing that. Because, if it's digital, it's just doing it.
Right. And I looked it up. It looks like it's going to be $2,000 with a lens and $1,400 without a lens.
But that's the price of that. What was that camera that came out about 2 years ago that shot video and pictures and did video and everybody wanted it? What was the Mark?
Mark II. Yeah, it's one of the Canon models, and I think a lot of the SLRs now have the video.
Right.
And I think the first – I don't know about the Canon, but I know the Nikons, the first ones that did video did not have autofocus. So you had to manually focus it, and they weren't – you know, that limited their use.
Sure.
They're getting better and better at that, and the video from these things is incredible. The video from these SLRs is really good.
Very cool. Okay, one more thing. Mike, go.
One more thing. This is a pretty cool one is Lytro. And I got this in the show notes. Lytro is coming up with a camera that, or a technique that they're going to put it in the camera, that you can focus the image after you've taken a shot. So what it has is it has all these little bitty micro lenses in front of the CMOS sensor. And you take the shot. You don't have to focus. You can shoot it with a lens that is wide open. That means it lets as much light in there as possible and giving you a lot of depth, a lot of blur in the depth of field. You can do that, and then later in software, you can decide, I want focus here. No, I want focus there. Oh, I want focus there. You can change the focus on where it is.
Wow. So
which
with
is
that,
incredible.
In the depth of field then for focus, can you split that across the picture so that this section of the picture comes into focus and this one comes into focus, but everything else is blurry?
I have a link here in the show notes, and what they had the picture as an example is a woman standing close up to the camera, and in the background is a flag, and you can either have her in focus, where she's in sharp focus and the flag behind her is out of focus, or you can click on the flag and the flag's in focus and she's out of focus.
Okay.
And it's just amazing how it does that. Right now, in order to share that image, you have to have their software to save the image in something where you can click on it, because obviously a regular JPEG file or GIF file or whatever is not going to do it. You have to have their thing. But you don't have to. I didn't download anything. Going to the site here where I'm looking at it, I didn't have to download anything to look at it. And what you could do, what you'll eventually be able to do is, so you have their software to pick the focus, then you would save it out as a normal JPEG.
All right.
So, I know Andrew's probably done the same thing I've done before, and anybody who takes pictures has done this, is that you have taken tons of out-of-focus images. You went meant to focus here, something got in the way, or you didn't do it right, and you focus on something else, and the subject you wanted is out of focus. And, this offers a solution.
Get out, child freak out.
It is, yeah. So as a photographer, I have mixed emotions about that. It kind of makes it, there goes one of the skills that a photographer has. But, and what they're saying is the first models of this will be out later this year, and they'll be consumer-grade models. So this is not like a $20,000 camera that's going to be coming out. They don't have any prices up yet, but they're saying in late 2011 they'll have the first consumer examples out.
Hmm. Interesting. I guess if you screw up your shot, you can you fix it. In your example, Mike, my thought would be if I could bring the girl into focus and the flag into focus but leave everything else, that might make a really interesting picture effect, right? Where you...
You know how you do that?
No. Oh, you take Photoshop. Two pictures. Yeah.
That is Photoshop.
There you go. I need to buy Photoshop. That should come free with Windows.
GIMP.
You're probably right.
I don't think Adobe would support that theory.
Yeah, since Photoshop costs more than the Windows.
Yeah.
Maybe Windows would come free with Photoshop.
It'd be nice to have. There you go. Windows Home Server probably could. The
Windows Home Server comes free with a mouse. You buy a Microsoft mouse, it's free Home Server.
I know. I think Windows Home Server comes free with Air. The what was I going to say? Shoot. Oh, the other night I had an image that I was trying to change and do some things, and Windows just does not have enough standard tools to really do that kind of stuff well. And I thought, God, I really need Photoshop to be able to manipulate this and add. What I wanted to do is take an image that was a square, and I wanted to add a bunch of space onto the end of it and then match that color gradient all the way down. And I guess there's some way to do that in Windows. Maybe you can do it in Paint. I don't know.
Do that in GIMP.
So, but that's not Windows, right? That's another program I got to download.
It's a free image editing program.
Maybe I'll try GIMP. Maybe we can talk about that next show. Christian, in 1 minute, do your tip of the week.
Oh, all right. So,
thanks, Mike. By the way, while Christian's getting ready, good stuff. So, and before the show is out, do the camera thing one more time.
Okay, I'll get ready.
Go, Christian.
Go ahead.
All right. So, my kind of speed tip integration thing of the week is the Seismic Desktop 2. And this is a really neat way to integrate your Twitter, Facebook, Google Buzz, everything social into one hub. Got some nice newsletter style menu columns. it kind of, just like when you get a new email at Outlook, a little corner pop-up comes up with a new when someone posts or does whatever. You get this really crazy sound that actually sounds like it's coming from the other room, and it's really confusing, but it's really cool all at the same time. And you can customize colors. You can post to all of your accounts at once from the thing, and it's pretty neat.
Very cool. Yeah, check that at Seesmic, SEESMIC.com.
Yeah, and it's got a really nice interface, and it's really customizable.
And that's for both PC and
Mac,
Android and Mac
and web and
web and all that stuff. They've got it all, huh?
Yeah, but the desktop is just cool.
Very cool. Excellent. Andrew, anything you wanted to add to the show? We kind of blew through that Skype story, but you got anything else you want to add tonight?
No, I've just enjoyed sitting here listening to you guys and throwing in the odd opinion, and it's pretty good.
Yeah.
Back in the seat. It's good.
Nice. It's good to have you. Good to have you on tonight. All right, Mike, you ready? You ready for the outtake of the and let that thing rip. I want a runway effect here when you take that picture. Here we go.
If I went and got mine, we could have like double cross, we could cross the beams and have like machine fire on there.
All right, you ready?
Yeah, let her rip. I love this. Go.
Nice. Is that enough?
That's awesome. Thank you very much.
Are you going to have to delete all those pictures now?
I'm just going to format the card.
So how many pictures do you think it took in that?
It's still writing them. 70. I don't know how many it had when I started, but it has 72 it's taken now. So I don't think I took that many before. So let's say, 30 or 40 it just took.
Nice. Wow, that fast.
It's blazing. If you're shooting with I turned it to JPEG, by the way.
Okay, so not RAW.
If you're shooting with RAW, you can eat up a card really fast.
Yeah. How much bigger is RAW than JPEG usually on a 1-to-something scale?
Well, my D2X, JPEG will be in the, 3 gig range, 3 meg range, and a RAW will be 13, 14 meg.
All right, so 3-to-1.
Yeah.
4-to-1. Mm-hmm. All right.
Can I do one more thing?
Yeah, go ahead.
That was hidden.
Oh, go. Yeah.
Okay, so, in my massive use of a program called Excel all the time.
Yes.
Always using Excel.
And if you're interested in more details, listen to last week's show.
Yeah, exactly. As I move around, I've run into a problem, and I wonder if you guys do this. So I have a lot of things open at the bottom of the screen, and my mouse accidentally touches the taskbar, boom, and all these windows pop up instantly. Not the full window, but the outline of them. Have y'all had that happen?
Sure.
Yeah.
And I was moving back and forth a lot at work, and it was driving me absolutely nuts. And I found a way you can change the default timing of that, so you, instead of it happening instantly, you can put a delay.
Oh.
And I have it in the show notes. Mm-hmm. You do have to go into the registry settings, but you can change the delay. So now I don't have that problem at work. If I accidentally touch it for that second or whatever, it doesn't automatically pop up.
Very cool. Hey, is there a way, speaking of that, of little tips, is there a way to shut off that auto, if you go all the way to the bottom right-hand corner on a Windows 7 desktop and it goes to desktop mode and everything disappears?
Oh, I thought that's what we were talking about.
No. Is that what you're talking about, Mike?
Sorry, desktop?
No, I'm talking about where, and I for some reason I can't have it happen here on my screen.
Christian, you know what I'm talking about, right? If you're on Windows 7, you go all the way to the bottom right hand.
Yeah.
It says show desktop, but when you hover over it, everything you have on your desktop, right, just goes down. Can you disable that?
Mine doesn't do it.
Oh.
Yeah, you can change your.
I might have hacked it. Don't do that.
Yeah, maybe
I think
so.
If you turn off desktop composition, it won't do it.
Okay.
Check.
Well, there's a setting. If you know what that is, come out to Facebook. Find us on Facebook and post that at the Average Guy Podcast on Facebook. Just type in Average Guy Podcast and search for that and find us. You don't even have to sign up to post on that site, and that's where we're trying to move all of our show notes to. Guys, I'll remind you again, RSS feeds are switching over from Podomatic to IX Web Hosting, or actually FeedBurner, to be honest. And so if you are listening to the show, long one today, but if you're listening to the show and you haven't switched your RSS feed, get out there and get that done. We are giving a Drobo away at the homeservershow.com, so pop out there, just all one word, homeservershow.com, look for the Drobo post, and if you want to win a Drobo, if you don't know what a Drobo is, go to Drobo.com, check that out. We're giving away a Drobo S, and just the capital letter S, and sign up at thehomeserver.com. Actually, you don't sign up there. You go to Drobo and sign up, but the links are there. And you too could win a free Drobo. And, guys, by the way, that's global, Andrew.
International shipping. Cool.
International shipping included. So if you want to win that, do it. All right, guys, thanks for coming on tonight. Christian, good to have you. I'm looking forward to school starting so we get you on a regular basis.
Yeah.
From here on out, it seems like we've missed you more than we've had you this summer, but you've had some important things to do. Your sister's in college, is that?
Yep.
Yeah, so you got the house to yourself.
That's right.
Nice. That's
Left
that's
the Tech Dominion rule on.
Is this her freshman year?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a new experience for you at the Johnson mm-hmm. place. All right.
Yes.
Good deal. Well, she's doing well, I take it, at this
Very
point.
Very well, yeah.
All right, good stuff. Mike, great having you out tonight and adding the camera shutter machine gun fire.
nice to be on.
to the show. Good to have you on. And you know what? We didn't even argue about Excel.
No, you know, the Excel was just a little side note. You know, the strange thing is I can't get it to do here at work what I was the effect I was talking about. Yeah. I mean, at home. Yeah. But no, it was just a little tidbit just to bring that up.
And if you're interested in what we're talking about, go last week's show 41, go to the end of it, and there's some conversation around Excel. Actually, you got to listen to the whole show because I really rip Excel while we're in there. So anyways, Andrew, good to have you out tonight as well, and appreciate you coming out and hanging out and being with us.
Yeah, well, good.
Yeah, good stuff. So remind folks, we record every Thursday evening, 7 p.m. or so. We're actually on time tonight or pretty close to it, 7 p.m. Central time, which is about 11 o'clock or something like that in Australia, 11 o'clock a.m. or noon or whatever, something like that. And so I know we have a few Australian listeners, and you can listen live out at theaverageguy.tv/live. Gentlemen, have a great evening. Or Andrew, you have a great afternoon, and we'll do it all again next week. Mike, did I see something about – I saw something come through my – oh, here it is.
I'm going to go on mute super fast.
Okay, that's fine. Waffle House measures hurricane recovery.
I emailed that to you. That is a Wall Street Journal article, and it's come up before with FEMA, where they FEMA gauges how bad the storm is based upon what they find with Waffle House when they get there.
Yeah.
So if they come there and they find that we're there at full menu, everything's fine. They come there and find that we're already there with a limited menu, then they got problems they need to get to working. If they come there and find it's not open, it's a disaster.
Really?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And so in every one of those scenarios, the key point was – we're already there, and FEMA is coming in after us.
Yeah,
but that's no, great. we do a real good job of doing this disaster, preparedness.
Yeah, I see this Waffle House van, right? It looks like
that's
it's a
RV. We bought it after Katrina because with Katrina we ran into a problem. We could not find hotel rooms to put people. And we couldn't. We found, had problems with hotel rooms. They had problems with communication. So that thing has satellite phones.
There's sleeping. A link, guys. If you want to look at it. Yeah. So this RV, you can. Is that they don't? You don't sell out of that. It's no. Just okay. That's for workers.
Transportation and communication is almost like a command center. And they damaged it in Irene.
Really?
They went in a little bit too early.
Ooh. Oops.
And you know the sides of it pop out for expanded sleeping areas, and I guess the winds were strong enough that even though the sides were pushed in, that the gasket that goes around that got broken, and they ended up having to because it broke off and it was like flapping and hitting up against the side of the van. They had to cut it off so they could keep going.
Wow!
Yeah, it went in a tad too early.
Oops! Waffle House a little ahead of the game now. Going up the East Coast, Waffle House is how far up?
We go up to like Delaware, Pennsylvania. Okay. But that's about it. That's it.
So not into Vermont?
No, not into Vermont. Okay. But, you know, North Carolina, that's where it made landfall.
Right.
And we have a number of restaurants there.
Any damage that couldn't open back up? Or
I think we've had one that was damaged, and the others might have had to close for a little bit as the storm went through. But they were all open pretty quickly thereafter. And you know, even if they don't have power, we have gas. That's what we do all our cooking with is gas. Yeah. And it's almost never that goes away. And we can bring in a generator for the rest of the power. So we have that. We have two other trucks that come in with gasoline or whatever else they need.
Yeah.
And then we'll stage outside of that area supplies. So, chicken and ice and whatever else that we're going to be selling, we'll stage that outside the area.
Any chance that a Waffle House will be coming to a Melbourne location anytime soon?
No plans to go overseas, sorry, Andrew.
Bummer.